I believe. And certainly thank you for inviting us.
While we collect the first set of questions, I'm going to ask Peter if you would like to respond to anything you heard, or otherwise I have a first question for...
Go ahead.
Well, and maybe we'll answer this at the end, because I don't want to put you on the spot, but I think that when I heard each of you speak, you each referenced other thinkers in terms of folks who are writing or speaking about the issues of the day. And so maybe at the end of our question and answer period, you could each leave us with one or two others who you are reading or interacting with who would be interesting for us to read or interact with in the next phase of this. So that's, and if you're ready to go with that, that's fine. Otherwise, you're sorting the questions. Okay, all right. So, well, let's go then. If you have a thought on that.
Well, I've already referenced Tom Friedman, and I know it's easy for somebody to become kind of a celebrity status, and then you sort of diminish the value of what they have to say. But also he's been very outspoken both for and against the war, and so that somewhat is undermining perhaps everybody's paying attention to what he says about globalization. But it affects things. Our son just got back from Iraq, so let me tell you, it does affect things. But I read Tom Friedman. I read a lot of Asian newspapers. My own limitation is while I'm taking Chinese, I can't read it well enough to read Chinese, but I read the Asian Wall Street Journal. I read the Asian Times. I am most interested in Asia and what it presents to the future. I read The Economist, which I think is a great weekly look at the rest of the world. I try to listen to the BBC when I can. One of the great benefits of traveling is that you get outside and you see your own country through the eyes of other people. And so I think the greatest thing you can do, even though you have to wait in line and never take shampoo anymore, I just urge everyone to travel. I think the worst fallout of 9/11 is that we are becoming more and more fearful of each other, and that does not bode well for working together to solve global problems.
First, I think it's good to get the facts versus the partisan view of something on demographics and that. So I think it's important to go to a nonpartisan body and get facts that are important to your business. I think that is critical in running it. The second thing, in any business, it's good to get close to your customers. If you have an employer in your district, get to know that team, get to know those employees, and what it takes to grow that company in Minnesota. First step in any business is getting to know its customers, what do they need, and one of your customers is the companies that you represent. And second is the educational institutions that you represent. There are challenges, and one of the great economic engines we have, for example, we are sitting in it today. It's the University of Minnesota. It's a great economic engine. And what are its needs to prepare us for the next century? So I would talk to the leadership of the educational institutions that also make this state great.
I will also add, you're going to be too busy to read this during the session, but when you get out of the session, you might want to think about it. I'm right now reading a 300-year-old book, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, by Edwin Gibbons. And I'm also reading a book on the history of Greece. And another thing that's very fascinating when you read about antiquity is you realize you can have an absolutely thriving civilization that people assume will go on forever. And a lot of the same principles and the same forces brought down those civilizations. So it's always interesting to realize that where you are is not where you will always be, nor it is where we have always been. So anyway, not to be too somber, but it's fascinating to look at how rich those civilizations were, and they came apart when the infrastructure broke down. So.
I could fill in one quick plug for my own magazine. There really is very little that I talk about that isn't said much better in this magazine. I was just thinking today that the whole question about selling off infrastructure, is that a good idea? State legislators very appropriately question that. And it's a very emotional issue for a lot of people. There's a good article in here about the pros and cons of doing that and why it is the two governors who have, have incredible financial backgrounds, Mitch Daniels and John Corzine, want to do it. It's done all the time in Europe. There are other people who say it's a terrible idea, particularly politically. But it's all spelled out here. Performance measurement article here about that, too. So we work hard to do that. I felt that when we started governing 20 years ago, there wasn't a Forbes or Fortune or Business Week for people in your jobs. And so we tried to do that. So I learn a lot from it. I learn a lot from the website. And I could say that not having an awful lot of input into the editorial product except general direction. And then I want to reiterate The Economist. I think The Economist is really the most incredible news weekly. And it has much more international view than Time or Newsweek, which I find are very parochial and becoming more so. And then finally, not, a lot of you won't like this, but the New York Times is the greatest newspaper in this country. And, it's, and I don't always agree with it. Very often I don't agree with its editorial policy. But just as a news-gathering organization, it is a fine enterprise, and it is better than it's ever been.
Well, thank you for that. And now I'll start with your questions. And I think some of these are directed to one of you. And then if you feel if the other two need to respond or feel like you can add something, please do. Otherwise, we'll keep moving through the questions. So, Peter, I think this is directed at you. Your comments regarding the concentration of wealth suggest there is a value in greater distribution of wealth. And what role do you think government should play in policies to build greater distribution of wealth?
Well, I don't know. What interests me about this problem is that it is a worldwide phenomenon, and the numbers in the U.S. actually are a little better than they are in the world. A rather larger percentage of people control the same amount of 40% of the wealth. But it isn't by a whole lot, and wealth has been concentrating more here. And people like our Treasury Secretary, Mr. Paulson, and Ben Bernanke, the head of the Fed, are really worried about it because they're very concerned that, that if the fruits of globalized economy aren't felt by a larger number of people, it won't be politically sustainable. And I think that's what you're referring to with trade problem. And I think you're beginning to see the first signs, and there are strong signs of a revolt against free trade in this country. As somebody said last night at dinner, it's darn hard to find a Democrat in the U.S. Congress who's going to stand up for free trade, as did Bill Clinton and sold it. So I think that's a problem. Taxation policy has a lot to do with it. I see real problem with, my problem with the strategy of selling off infrastructure, for instance, is that is a business model that is based off of private companies coming in, taking over these roads. They are toll roads. And guess what? They're going to raise the tolls a lot. I see a problem with hot lanes and so on. People are having to pay more to do the same stuff. And for wealthier people, that's not such a big problem. And it's worth it for middle-class folks, it gets more and more difficult. I see more and more responsibility being put on middle-class, particularly lower middle-class people, and a lot of them are very close to the breaking point, and that's a real concern. What do you do about it? Taxation policy certainly has something to do with that. You want to make things less regressive, more progressive, rather than what we're doing now, which I think is the opposite. And then education does offer everybody the way out, and we have to concentrate on those kids that that are not doing so well. I think we have to be willing to put more resources into trying to bring them along. There are all kinds of programs that could prove that that is done if you put the proper resources and energy into it.
I'm going to make a statement that's probably going to be heretical. But I know a lot of people like to say Social Security is the fourth rail. I think public education is the fourth rail. I had a debate with, we were discussing world problems with lots of people over the weekend, and I said, you know, as a fourth generation Minnesotan, came from a family of dirt poor Irish immigrants. At one time, our public education system did exactly that. It was the the single most important thing that distributed wealth, because it created opportunity for everybody to make their own. And we will be held accountable if we reach a point in the 21st century where our public education system is the single biggest barrier to people doing the same thing. And it's a difficult problem. Nobody's got easy answers. But if we produce an entire underclass that has no hope or optimism, there's no reason why radicalism won't come here and be just as appealing to the people who don't have any hope here as it is in every other corner of the world. So anyway, I'm a big believer in create the opportunity for people to make their own wealth as opposed to letting people live in a hopeless world and then trying to redistribute at the end of the process instead of at the beginning. But anyway.
The numbers will show that economic disparity is tied to educational disparity. If you go back to the root of the countries that have economic disparity to the greatest degree, they also have educational disparity of an equal or greater degree.
And I will say, I think that the ability to go back to the well and say, just give us more money, without saying, here's what we actually are going to do that's going to deliver a different result, I think is we're at that point. People want a different result. So, I mean, and again, it's not easy, but anyway.
All right, next question. Janet, I think you might want to start this one, and then we'll see. And it doesn't have to be, I don't think the answer is long, but I think it's an interesting question. You mentioned world languages. Do you think that business would go to bat for earlier world language classes, earlier than ninth grade, or in some places middle school, it's still an option, but really lower than that in most places in Minnesota, it's not an option. Is that something that business could help us with in terms of the importance of it, as you pointed out?
Well, I think I hope this isn't the first time anyone is hearing that a need for workers of the future is to be multilingual. I mean, certainly business and the public sector. I mean, if you have 40% of the population coming in that speaks multiple languages, yes, and the earlier you start, the better, although I would say we are at such a disadvantage since we are, you know, thousands of miles generally, except for French in Quebec or perhaps Spanish in Miami, where you can really use it. But absolutely, the earlier and finding out what works in teaching language and you know, maybe the rote method that many of us went through and didn't produce very good results until we actually got out and used it isn't the best way to do it. So I think that would be coupled with how can we create multilingual children? Is it immersion programs? What is it? But again, education is such a factor in success. Young people going to private colleges or private schools, they're starting with Chinese in the kindergarten and first grade because their parents know it's going to be very important for their success in the future.
Anyone else? Okay. To succeed, state government needs business to operate as a partner. This is a question. What specific ideas do you have for how business can partner with state government, specifically in the area of early childhood education? What solutions can business offer to us? Bob?
Well, I think the first thing in any relationship is you got to know each other. I go out of my way to make sure that I have contacts on both sides of the aisle with people that I think are committed to this state. So the first thing is, if you don't know people in the members of the Minnesota Business Partnership, et cetera, create a forum where you can get to know them. They create a lot of jobs in this state, and that's the first step. The second step, and the business community is behind this, pre-K, getting kids ready for kindergarten, is good business. So when you have good business, make sure the numbers support that. And number two is, when you spend the money, show results. If you're going to invest in something, make sure it's measurable, because that's where your business partners come from. They come from investing and then showing results at the other side. So if you're going to make an investment that's important, make sure that you demonstrate the effectiveness.
Anyone else?
The one thing I would add is include people from all sectors. I think academia has something to offer too, but academia, public sector, and private sector together in planning on how to approach the issue, because the tendency is to want to have a global, pardon the use of the word at today's meeting, but a global solution. The tendency is, well, if we're going to do it, then it's got to be for everybody, and then we have to have 300 pages of rules, and then we, you know, and we tend to lose the concept of, let's start small, do an innovative test site, let's see what works, then let's expand it. But we do come out of the industrial age where it is all for one and one for all, butter knife approach to problems. And then that tends to allow the status quo to say, see, it didn't work. And then it breaks down. So I think one thing would be to work with people from the private sector on, you've been through a lot of change. I mean, you're going through what all of us in the industrial economy went through in the 1970s when Toyota came knocking on our door. And we know what it's like to go from bureaucratic to small and nimble, and so try to learn from each other.
One thing I've noticed is that there's a big difference between the business community in Washington, representing the business throughout the country, and the business communities in regions and cities and metro areas. The former U.S. Chamber of Commerce, I think, is ideologically very rigid and very dogmatic. The chambers of commerce around the country are totally different. They are becoming one of the great progressive forces in this country. It is the business community in Alabama, in Northern Virginia, in Colorado, and so on, that are becoming some of the most progressive forces in the state. And they really could care less whether they're Democrats or Republicans or liberals or conservatives who are running things. They want certain things done. And education, starting with preschool, is very, very top of the list. And they are willing to contribute money. They are willing to back candidates who support it. And so on. I'm seeing that as a real trend around the country, one that's very, very positive.
A number of you asked questions about sustainability, because all of you talked about that in your comments. And so kind of packaging a couple questions together here. One person asked, is sustainability or the lack of it just a matter of specific policies? And I'm going to give you a second question that I think fits in with that, and that is the tension between sustainability or the push for mergers and larger, you know, faster, and the tension inherent in those two things. Whichever of those things strike you as something that you can share something about here, sustainability and whether it's a set of policies that we have to get to, or I think the corollary to that is it truly a philosophy that has to take over the mindset of decision makers?
Well, in my world, the only key to independence is through performance. And I would argue that in the state's world and in your political world, that is the same thing. You need to be top performing. Any merger that is done where the organization at the end of the day does not become a top performer, that merger is undone 4 or 5 years later, and we see it all the time in the business world, of merger and acquisitions that don't work because they did not bring excellence. What matters is the economy gets more mobile and communication becomes more available and relevant in all the transactions that we do, is excellence matters. And if you do not deliver it, someone else will. And they do not have to be next door. They can be in India. They can be in China. They can be in South Dakota. Excellence is the key to independence.
I'm not sure I'm quite clear on the what they are referring to as sustainable, so I'll take a stab at it. If the question is, can we sustain the economic drivers of our current economy, or meaning largely the businesses that are here and the employees that the employment they provide, or are they just going to get merged and we're going to end up with fewer companies and there's nothing we can do about it? Is that the question? Anyway, I will say, no, we cannot sustain what we currently have, or I don't think we will, because many of the companies we currently have are emerged in the industrial economy. And so what we have now is excess capacity, and mergers represent the consolidation of excess capacity. and we've got a lot of cheap capital, so some of them aren't good mergers either. So they provide access to capital that then is not used efficiently. But so trying to hold on, like picking up a handful of sand on the beach, trying to hold on to what you have is not sustainable. Trying to create new businesses, whether it is lots of research at the new companies, at the companies that are here, so over time they actually evolve into something else, trying to create research so that you have, as I say, the next Google, you know. The real opportunity is how do you make this an attractive, rich, fertile soil, since we're an agriculture place, from which the drivers of the future economy are going to grow, even though we don't know what they are now. But we do know that if you have a well-educated workforce, if you have a lot of good research, and you start having some critical mass in some very key drivers of the economy, you're more likely than not going to find yourself having a sustainable economy over time.
I think on the public sector side, it's going to take a change of mindset. I think we've got some problems in the way we are allowing the economy to proceed, and we have to change how we look at things. I think the tipping point issue right now is global warming. You can argue for it or against it, but I think the debate is over. When you see companies like Shell Oil, whose chairman the other day came out and said, this is a real problem, we're not going to fight the science on this, it is happening. Carbon dioxide is soaring in the atmosphere. The planet is heating up, and carbon is a problem. When you hear that, you hear it from General Electric, you hear it from Hewlett-Packard, you hear it obviously from the insurance industry and other industries. You know that something's going on. And I think that the public sector, public policy in a way, is lagging. And in part because it's so darn complicated. But the way we are allowing growth to proceed, the way we are allowing living patterns to happen, the way we are allowing development to occur, the way we are not really tackling an overall question of the carbon economy, of automobile use, all of those things. There are answers, and we better start coming up with them soon. They involve stuff like planting trees. Our cities used to have many more trees than they do now. Now we're starting to get back at it. There are a lot of cities that are on massive tree planting program. There are multitude of answers, but there has to be some sense of overall direction of what it is we're going to do, and the public sector has got to be what provides that. And what surprises me is how quickly the private sector gets right in line or, in the case of some of these companies, leads the way, General Electric being a good example.
I'm going to follow up on that with Janet and Bob. What is the impact of global warming that you see directly on businesses? And that could probably be a doctoral thesis, but maybe, no.
Well, there's a lot of ways to tackle it, but there's some really practical problems. Number one is if you look at where the citizens of the U.S. have built, and with global warming recognized there's going to be disasters that will pale, make the old ones of the seem very small in comparison. How do you protect those citizens' residencies, businesses? Are we going to rebuild New Orleans? I mean, we're building on places that will disappear based on any rational environmental model, any rational model. They're going to go away. What do those citizens, what is the net that is going to catch those citizens? Give you one practical example. We did not loan any money down in the basin of New Orleans because I've chaired a casualty company. I knew it was going to go underwater. Just a question of when. It was not a question. And that's fact. For 20 years, we stayed out of that city on any borrowing of money.